Welcome to ITE 1, Module 7, Part 2 for Semester 2. Before we get into the lecture proper, are there any questions on labs or anything that we've talked about so far? Okay, I'm guessing there aren't, but if there are, you can write to instructors and we will do our best to answer them for you. Grace, do you have anything?
Do I have anything for what?
Do you have anything you want to talk about, labs or any issues?
Not really.
Or?
Everybody's doing well.
Yeah. Nice that I'm caught up now.
Just in case you've been living under a rock, the enable safe mode sound support works under all Windows from XP onwards. Just to get that out there in case you've been ignoring Cavi Discuss. The other thing I would suggest to people, don't blindly apply a registry patch. Open it up and see what keys it contains. I'm sure there's nothing wrong with Dina's registry patch, but you'll be able to find out what it does. Crack it open in Notepad.
So you can use JAWS in safe mode?
No, you cannot.
NVDA NVDA will work.
Well,
but
NVDA,
you'll at least get
well,
sound.
NVDA is better than nothing, yeah. It's a.
Sorry, move closer to your microphone, please, if
right.
you can.
Corey? Yeah, if you can.
I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
I was wondering about cabling or something that would convert from, like, say, a PATA, a machine that only supports PATA, and can you get cabling that will allow SATA drives to run on it effectively?
You have to get a SATA card.
No, you don't. You can actually get a little converter that converts a 40-pin on one side to a SATA port on the other, and you plug a little 3.5-inch power converter into it, and then you can just plug it onto your IDE cables and the other end into your SATA drives.
That's pretty cool.
And it works with the drivers and everything, or does it just turn into an IDE drive?
Turns it into an IDE drive if you don't have any SATA capability. Putting a SATA card in is all well and good, but if you don't have any SATA power, you're still going to be in trouble.
Now that, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, we left off talking about solid ink printers. The next couple of printers we're going to talk about are printers that are not as widely known about, and so I've never actually seen these, and some of these probably wouldn't make very interesting sounds, which is why I don't have any. So the first one is a solid ink printer. As the name suggests, they use solid sticks of ink rather than toner or ink cartridges. Solid ink printers produce high-quality images. The ink sticks are non-toxic and can be handled safely. Solid ink printers melt ink sticks and spray the ink through nozzles. The ink is sprayed onto a drum. The drum transfers the ink to paper. Pros to solid ink printers are that they are easy to use, the prints are vibrant, and they can use many different paper types. The downside to solid ink printers are that the printers themselves are expensive, the ink is also expensive, and they are slow to warm up. Wikipedia has interesting information on these, and there are also some satirical videos on YouTube about these that are quite funny, actually, that sort of dispute the easy to use and versatility factors in reality. So yeah, you might have a look at these if you're bored and have nothing else to do. There is a diagram in section 7.1.6 that explains the internal components of solid ink printers, and that's pretty pretty cool. I believe the last type is there's several types in here. Two other technologies that you might work with are thermal and dye sublimation. So thermal is first. These are often used in cash registers. They're the ones that, if you're buying something, they don't sound like the dot matrix printers that still give you a receipt. Some old fax machines use this technology as well. Thermal paper comes in rolls and has a waxy coating on it. the paper becomes black when heated. Printheads and thermal printers are usually the width of the paper being printed on. Areas of the printhead are heated as required to make the pattern on the paper. An advantage of these is that there are no moving parts, so they last a long time. The disadvantages are that paper is expensive, it has a short shelf life, so you have to use it quickly, and it must be stored at room temperature, and images are poor quality. Hang on just a second. Receipts kept in a wallet or pocket for too long will fade because of these temperature and other storage issues. I've kept receipts in my wallet that Dad's like, I can't read this anymore. This is why when you have an important receipt that you want to keep for a long time, you should scan both sides of it as soon as possible and keep the scans for your records. And they will take the scans. Carrie was telling me that a local store, I think it was J-Car, actually took scans of his receipts and was like, wow, these are awesome. Dye sublimation printers produce photo quality images for graphic printing. This type of printer uses solid sheets of ink that change directly from solid to gas in a process called sublimating. The print head passes over a sheet of cyan, magenta, yellow, and a clear overcoat, which is abbreviated CMYO. There is a pass for each color. The pros of these printers are that they produce very high quality images, and the overcoat layer helps prevent smearing. Cons are that the media can be expensive and that these printers are better for color than for grayscale, black and white. In photography, both dye sublimation and small color inkjet printers provide quality prints. The inkjets are producing, as it says, better and better quality prints all the time. And they're cheaper.
There was a printer out, which I don't think it stayed around real long, but it was like somebody had figured out that these printers that were using wax, and maybe they were the solid ink, but they talked about it as wax, and they'd figured out that you could build up enough layers of these to actually get readable Braille, and they were using it to sort of produce graphics with Braille, you know, embedded Braille and stuff like that.
Oh, are you talking about the pictures in a flash or the Pioff machines?
Maybe. Sounds vaguely.
Because what those were,
something.
It was very heavy flexi paper, they called it, and the way it worked is you'd put something through, and anything that was light, I forget if it was light or dark, but anything of either one of those would show up on kind of this waxy surface, and some things it made it a little hard to read, but it was very easy to put like a map on this thing and you'd get something that was at least somewhat usable.
Nah.
But the paper was really
I don't
expensive.
Think so. I think you're talking about the oven things, right? Where you,
no,
you
those could, are thermoform.
Yeah. Oh, so maybe this
is not
is it.
The same thing.
Maybe this was it. They were big. They were like these. I mean, I remember seeing one in an exhibit hall, you know, and they were like big blocky things. These printers.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. There's been a couple of technologies that are supposed to make tactile diagrams and stuff easier to produce. All right, we're going to talk about installing and setting up a printer. When you buy a printer, information about how to install and configure it is provided on by the manufacturer. An installation CD that includes drivers, manuals, and diagnostic software is included with the printer. The same material can be found on the manufacturer's website. Often the manufacturer's site will be more up to date than what is on the CD. So, it is your best resource for the latest drivers and extra printing software. This is going to likely be on the test. So, the site of the printer maker, or the scanner maker, or the whatever driver you're talking about, is the best place to get the most up-to-date information on a piece of hardware. So, you're going to see this a lot. Although all types of printers are somewhat different to connect and configure, there are procedures that should be applied to all printers. The very first thing you should do is read the instructions for setting up your printer from its manual or the quick start fold-out poster that has pictures or whatever. Get sighted help if you can when setting these things up. Next, unpack the printer. Take an inventory of what is in the box. Make sure that all of the proper cables are included. Cool, thank you. Pictures in a flash URL is in the chat. Find the ink and toner if it is present, and set the driver CD in a place where you will find it again. Remember, printers generally do not come with paper, and not all printers come with USB cable or ink or toner. Be sure to feel for and remove any sheets of plastic, labels, or tape that have been placed inside the printer. These can be found in the ink and toner cartridge holders, paper tray, and some other really odd places. It is important to remove all of this extra packing material, or you could damage your printer when you first try to use it. Next, move the printer to its desired location. Make sure that this location gives the printer plenty of ventilation and has easy access to a power point or outlet. Printers can be heavy, so remember to use proper safe lifting procedures, which means that you need to bend your knees when you're lifting heavy things. Don't lift from your back. You could pull it out and that would be an ouch. Install the toner or ink cartridges in the printer, making sure to remove any plastic tabs that seal them. Many a person has ruined a printer by jamming the cartridge and not pulling off that little piece of tape and then having it not work properly. Someone had mentioned that they had done that in the newsroom of a radio station. I was just like, okay. Insert the paper, labels, or envelopes into the paper tray and attach the paper tray to the printer if it is not already attached, if it's removable. Now that the printer is set up in the location we need, we have to plug it into the computer, print server, or network, and plug the power cord into a power outlet. A printer can be connected and used as a local or network printer. A local printer is connected directly to a computer port, such as a USB, parallel, or serial port. The local computer manages and sends the print jobs to the printer. Local printers can be shared over the network with other users. A network printer is connected to a network using a wireless or an Ethernet connection. The network printer allows multiple users to send documents to the printer over the network without another computer necessarily being involved unless you use a print server. After determining if the printer will be a local or a network printer or a shared printer, connect the appropriate data cable to the communication port on the back of the printer. If it is a local printer, connect the other end to the computer. If it is a network printer, you will need to connect it to a network device such as a router. Once this is done, attach the power cord to the printer if necessary and plug it into a power point or outlet. Warning: never plug a printer into a UPS. This is especially true for laser printers because the power surge that occurs when the printer is turned on damages the UPS unit. Laser printers draw, just to give you an idea, in our lab, as I was mentioning last week at work, with one of the printers we had, I don't know if the newer one does this, but my friend was telling me that every time it would print, the lights would dim briefly because it draws that much power to get warmed up and get started. Save the space on your power supply for something else that you should go in, especially if your printer is not that expensive. Just, you know, use the UPS for stuff that would be more difficult to replace. After you've connected the power and data cables to the printer, if it is plug and play, the operating system should discover the printer and attempt to install a driver. If you have a driver disk from the manufacturer, use this driver. You can also use the driver from the website. The driver that is included with the printer is usually more current than the driver used by the operating system. The Add Printer Wizard can also be used to install the new printer. some printers will say install our driver before you plug in the printer. Do not install it. Do not plug it in until we tell you to. Others will say plug it in, hit cancel, and then install our driver. This is why reading the directions on setup is so important, because there are variations between these, and you can't just assume that you know how to do it, although we give some general information. But every printer is slightly different. A printer driver is a software program that enables the computer and the printer to communicate with each other. Drivers also provide an interface for the user to configure printer options. Every printer model has a unique driver. Printer manufacturers frequently update drivers to increase the performance of the printer, to add options, or to fix problems. You can download new printer drivers from the manufacturer's website. Step 1. Find out if a newer driver is available. Go to the printer manufacturer's website. Most manufacturers' websites have a link from the main page to a page that offers drivers and support. Make sure the driver is compatible with the computer that you are updating. This refers to the operating systems and architecture. So, make sure if you have a 64-bit system, you get drivers that are designed for 64-bit processors. Do not install 64-bit drivers on a 32-bit system. It won't work. And this is something that I probably talked about later, but I'll bring it up now. If you are doing the shared printer from a computer that you wish to use, make sure that the... basically, my dad tried to do this. He was on a computer with Windows Vista, and the computer that the printer's connected to uses Windows XP. And he said, oh, yeah, just copy the driver. It'll be fine. No, it wasn't. And that was a pain to fix. Step 2 is to download the driver, and you're going to download the driver files to your computer. Most driver files come in a compressed or zipped format, or they may be an EXE program. Download the file to a folder and uncompress or unzip the contents if necessary. Save any instructions or documentation to a separate folder on your computer. Install the downloaded driver, and you do install the driver. The downloaded driver either automatically or manually. Most printer drivers have a setup file that automatically searches the system for older drivers and replaces them with the new one. If no setup file is available, follow the directions that are supplied by the manufacturer. Step 4, test the new driver. Run multiple tests to make sure the printer works properly. Use a variety of applications to print different types of documents. Change and test each printer option. And Windows also has some self-test options, which we'll come to in a moment. Firmware is a set of instructions stored on the printer. The firmware controls how the printer operates. The procedure to upgrade firmware is very similar to the procedure for installing printer drivers. We don't get any more information than this, therefore it is something you... If it's something you need to do, consult the manual or the manufacturer's website. Follow their directions to the letter. You do not want to brick your printer. I've only had one firmware update fail, but it was probably the scariest thing that's happened to me in a very long time in technology land. And it wasn't my device either. So that was bad. And I didn't do anything wrong either. It just didn't go the way it should have gone. Adding printer memory to a printer can improve the printing speed and allow the printer to handle more complex print jobs. All printers have at least some amount of memory inside. Generally, the more memory a printer has, the more efficiently it operates. Consult the printer documentation for memory requirements. These include memory specifications. Some printer manufacturers use standard types of memory, and other manufacturers use proprietary memory. Check the documentation for the type of memory and the speed of the memory and the capacity of the memory. Memory population and availability. Some printers have multiple memory slots. To find out how many memory slots are used and how many are available, you might need to open a compartment on the printer to check memory population. Upgrading printer memory steps: 1. Turn off the printer. 2. Disconnect all cables. 3. Open a memory compartment. 4. Replace memory modules or add new modules. 5. Close the memory compartment. 6. Reconnect all cables. 7. Power on the printer. And 8. Run a self-test. 9. Print a test page. And we'll come to test pages. Basically, there's a... In the properties of a printer, there's a button that allows you to print a test page. It'll print and it'll say, did you see the test page? Does it look okay? If you choose, hang on just a moment, if you choose yes, it'll say, all right, everything's good. If you choose no, if it doesn't look right, then you'll get a troubleshooter. And that's pretty much how the Windows self-test goes. But you should also play with different applications. Make sure Word works. Make sure Excel works. Make sure my lovely word processor 8 that nobody really uses except you works. All right, what's your question, Melissa?
Yeah, this is probably a dumb question, but when you upgrade the memory modules on the computer or the printer, what is that something a computer technician could easily do? Because I remember reading back in one of the things they say don't computer technicians are really shouldn't repair the monitor and the power supply, and I think something said printers too. So is this something that
you can do printers by... You just have to be really careful that you don't go into areas of the printer that have high voltages and stuff. This is why you read the manufacturer's directions and look and see if it's something that sounds like you can actually do before you crack it open and try and do it. And if you're not comfortable doing it with the idea, get a tech to do it. You don't want to break it, especially if it's not yours.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah, just was wondering. Maybe a stupid question, but
And that's a very good question. That's not a dumb question at all. It's a very good question. So I'm glad you asked it. Any other questions? I heard someone key up earlier, and I wasn't sure if it was... Oh, John, you have a question.
What exactly is a print server? Is it a device that lets you share a printer over a network, or what's that referring to?
It is, and it also is one of the problems with that can happen sometimes is that when you are printing to a network printer without a print server or a printer connected to a computer that you're sharing using printer sharing, the computer still does a lot of the processing of the print job. A print server allows another computer to handle more of that so that the computer that you're actually using doesn't have to deal with that. And it's more important if you're doing complex documents, graphics, and so on. If you have a server that you can hand that off to, it will do the rendering and all of that, and then the source computer doesn't have to waste time trying to do that. So that's I believe I have that correct. That's something I think that's covered more in Chapter 14, actually, which is the advanced one, which is not something we'll teach, and the labs aren't required. We'll grade them if you really want to do them. But it can be an okay read, I guess. Any other questions? All right, we'll move on to identify configuration options and default settings. Each printer might have configurations and default options, so you should check the documentation for information about these configurations and default settings. Here are some common configurations that are available for printers: paper type, standard, draft, gloss, or photo; print quality, draft, normal, photo, or automatic; economy might also be in here too; color printing, multiple colors used; black and white printing is only black ink is used; grayscale printing, color image is printed using black ink in different shades of gray. paper size, standard paper sizes or envelopes and business cards. Paper orientation is landscape or portrait. Recall that landscape is printed where the print runs from the narrower side of the paper. Landscape prints sideways across the paper. Print layout, normal, banner, booklet, or poster. Duplex is where you can have normal or two-sided printing. For paper types, this may be particularly important for laser printers, and the documentation for my printer suggests that you should set it appropriate to what you're printing, because if you are using a plastic paper or labels or something and you don't tell it, it says that it is possible that the paper could melt if the printer is not aware of what type of paper it will print on. So that's something that you may want to look at in your documentation if it talks about printing tips. I've not had that happen, but I mostly print on standard paper. And I remind my dad every time, when you print on labels, change it, because we don't want meltage. Optimizing printer performance is the next one. This is usually done in the software that comes with the drivers, which can include tools to optimize performance. Common examples of these are the following. Print spool settings, cancel or pause currently printing current print jobs in the printer queue. Color calibration, adjust settings to match the colors on the screen to the colors on the printed sheet. Paper orientation, select landscape or portrait. Image layout, this is mentioned again, and I'm not sure why. They're talking about the landscape, and actually that can improve performance depending on what kind of document you're doing. It makes spreadsheets easier. At first I wasn't really sure if it was a performance enhancement to print on landscape, but now that I think about it, it actually is. Cisco thinks it is too. After installing a printer, you should print a test page to verify that the printer is operating properly. The test page confirms that the driver software is installed and working correctly, and that the printer and computer are communicating. So, you can, to do this, in Windows XP, you're going to go Start, Printers and Faxes, and find the printer you want, and actually the path for these is pretty similar, and you can find it in your notes. But you're going to right click the printer that you want, and on the properties there's going to be a print test page on the general tab as I described. So I've talked about that briefly, so I'm going to skip that. You can also test a printer by printing a test page from an application such as Notepad or WordPad. Notepad and WordPad are easy to find. I'm not going to go over how to find those. Most printers have a front panel with controls to allow you to generate test pages. This method of printing enables you to verify the printer operation separately from the network or computer. Consult the printer manufacturer's website or documentation to learn how to print a test page from the front panel of the printer. You can also print, some printers have like a special sequence where you open the cover a certain number of times and press a button and sing the printer test page printing dance, or, you know, song and dance, so that it actually works. One of them I looked at, I was like, holy crap, that's confusing. I don't know how people are going to remember that. You can also print from the command line to test the printer if it is a parallel printer or a serial printer, but they mostly parallel. You may not need to do this as often as you used to do, but here's how you do it. It's limited to ASCII files only, such as .txt and .bat. To send a file to the printer from the command line in Windows XP, first you have to open the command prompt, and you can either do that from the run box by typing cmd or using the search box. And when the command prompt is open, you do print, and their example is thefile.txt. The last section, I believe, on printers is describing printer sharing. This enables multiple users or clients to access a printer that they are not directly connected to. This is helpful because not every computer on the network will need its own printer attached to it. Not every secretary needs her own printer. That just gets crazy. This is accomplished by having other clients' computers connect to the computer with the shared printer attached and having it print the document for them. Setting up printer sharing is simple with Windows XP and with Windows Vista. That's supposed to be. The following steps enable a computer to share a printer. In Windows XP, click Start Printers and Faxes, and in Windows Vista, you're going to click Start Control Panel Printers. In 7, I think it's called Devices and Printers. I haven't actually played with printers on this computer. Right-click the printer and choose Properties. Select the Share tab. Click the Share This Printer Radio button and keep or change the share name. And click Apply. All of the computers that use the shared printer must have the correct drivers installed. Drivers for other operating systems can be installed on the print server if you use one. To connect to the printer from another computer on the network in Windows XP, choose Start Printers and Faxes, Add Printer. In Windows Vista, choose Start Control Panel Printers, Add Printer. The Add Printer wizard appears. Follow the steps using the wizard. This wizard allows you to browse to the computer with the printer on it and select the printer. Additionally, the wizard may offer to sometimes you might need to type in the computer name. That worked better for me when I did this. Additionally, the wizard may... No problem.
Cool. See you later.
Hope you enjoyed it. Additionally, the wizard may offer to copy the drivers from the computer with the printer over for you. If you know the OS is the same on both of them and are confident about the security of the shared computer, you can use this option if you wish. However, it's not guaranteed to work. And if the OSs don't match, then doing this is a very bad idea, as I explained. When we had problems with that, we had to do a system restore, so that wasn't really all that fun to figure out. Any questions on printers before we move on to scanners?
I have a really quick question.
Sure.
I have noticed that printers nowadays are printing with the last page first. Is there a way that could be changed? Because I printed out an assignment once and not realizing it, because I like to staple my assignments if they're 2, 3, 4 pages long. That way they're organized. And so I would just grab the first page out of the printer thinking it was page 1 and then put the second page underneath it. And it actually turned out that I was stapling them with the last page on top. And, of course, my college professor was like, you know, what's this all about? And I was just like, oh, I don't know, there's my assignment. But apparently some printers nowadays are printing. Is there a way
that can
be changed?
That's an option that's configurable, and I forget where it is. But what I would say is, now that you know it's doing it, and if you can get it to do it consistently, I'd keep it that way. Because that way you don't have to grab each page and restaple it.
That's pretty cool. It's
get
just,
it to,
if I had known
on laser
that it was
printers,
doing that.
That's not as cool.
Oh.
Because laser printers generally come out with the print at the top facing down towards you, if you print the pages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they're usually in really good order. But because of the way inkjets print, it can be more convenient to actually have it print in reverse order so that your document is already lined up. Also, you have to be careful that when you're shuffling those pages around, you're not smearing the ink as you go as well. Because remember... printouts don't come out dry.
No, the ink is still very wet. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you can, get used to reverse print order, and I loved it when I found it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah, I have no problem with it. I think it's really neat. But when I'd print at
but you just didn't know it was doing it. Yeah.
And some people just don't tell me, and then when I go to organize my stuff, I'm always putting the last page on top. So now I've gotten into the habit where, is your printer reverse order? I have to ask them. And some people are like, huh? They look at you like they have no clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, are these pages numbered 1 to 5 or 5 to 1 starting from the top? That's okay, because I used to staple them. I didn't know which way the printout was coming out, and I used to staple them on the bottom right-hand corner.
I have a question on printer sharing. Where it like says you have to every computer has to have a driver for the printer. Do you have to have the driver installed before you go to share the printer? Because you talked about the
absolutely with absolutely.
Right.
At least that's how I've always done it.
Does the module explain what a print spool is? I had a question about that, and I didn't go back and look it up, but I didn't remember seeing it.
I believe it does in the very, very last section, which everybody should be reading because it's the common problems and solutions. I'm pretty darn sure it's in there.
Okay, thanks.
All right, here we go on scanners. As a blind or visually impaired user, like I said, you're doubtless familiar with scanners. Maybe not, but a lot of us know about them because they're pretty helpful. And hopefully you know that, you know, OCR is out there. However, we also need to know how to select one for a customer or for ourselves, install and configure a scanner, and troubleshoot problems with them. So, here are the scanner types, resolution, and interfaces. Scanners convert a printed document into an electronic image or text using OCR that a computer can treat as a file and work with just as it does with any other file. You can store, edit, or email the saved files resulting from a scan. Scanners can also scan in pictures and images of pages as well. Though most scanners perform the basic task of scanning a page or image, there are different types of scanners available that may accomplish this in different ways. As with printers, the features, quality, and speed of the different types of scanners vary. Scanners typically create an RGB image, red, green, blue, that can be converted into common image formats such as JPEG, TIFF, BMP, and PNG. And we talked about RGB images last week, so I'm going to actually, unless anyone has any objections, I would like to skip that. As we said, some scanners have the ability to create text documents using optical character recognition, OCR software. OCR software converts a scanned printed page into text that can be edited with a word processor. And it looks at the picture and tries to find the letters in the picture. For us, there's two approaches to this process. There are blindness-specific, blindness-related programs like Kurzweil 1000, 3000, and OpenBook. Or you can have an off-the-shelf product like Abbey Fine Reader and OmniPage, or I guess if you still have the old TextBridge, you could use... My Braille transcriber absolutely loved TextBridge, and I feel bad for him because it's gone now. That was a Xerox one. The blindness products are much more expensive, and they're kind of cool because you can... scan while you're reading. That's one of the things I like about them. And if you just want to put a piece of mail on, press a button and hear what it is, it's great. But because of the added cost, you may not want to do that. If you're comfortable with your screen reader, you may save quite a bit of money by using an off-the-shelf product. And we are not going to have a which blindness product is better debate, because those go on forever.
Can I ask something about off-the-shelf stuff? I didn't actually get this. I assume it came with Office Professional, not regular Office, but I seem to just have this Microsoft document scanning software in my computer, and it worked
fine. Does it do OCR too?
It does OCR. You have to know, cool. You don't read it in the product, you just say save it to Word document, and there's my OCR, there's my text.
Yeah, that's how a lot of them work.
Yeah. And it seems to do a pretty good job. I mean, you know, as good a job as any of them do. You know, for like just plain text, it's great.
Another difference between the off-the-shelf ones is that most sighted people are not going to be scanning a book cover to cover. Whereas a blind person, you may have to if that's the only way you can get it. But with electronic resources, that's not as necessary as it once was. So that's really the main, that's one of the main differences between the two. Alright, the resolution of a scanner is measured in dots per inch, DPI. The higher the DPI number, the better the quality of the image. As with printers, you have to have an interface on the scanner and computer so that you can connect them together and use them. The interfaces need to be the same on the computer and the scanner, or things won't work. These are generally the same, or typically the same, as the ones for printers that we talked about earlier. Actually, in the olden days, there were a lot of SCSI scanners, and those were, actually some of those were really, workhorse scanners that worked really well. But finding cards that will work, computers that will work with them, is a little harder. SCSI scanners. I'm sorry. Why did I say PCI? That's totally and utterly wrong. I'm talking about SCSI scanners.
You did say SCSI.
Okay. I thought I said PCI for a minute, and that was wrong. Would someone like to define an all-in-one device for me? What are these?
Oh, the printer, scanner, copier, fax, whatever those things are.
Yeah, that's what an all-in-one does. And some of them even let you plug in like your camera memory card and choose from menus and print pictures in it, which is not going to be accessible for us. But some of these have card readers in them. So, as you described, they combine multiple devices with different functionality into one unit. Print, scan, copy, and fax documents are the common functions of these guys. According to the text, some also have media card readers or hard drives for storage. I've never seen this, but I'm not saying they don't. I've just never seen one. All-in-one devices are typically used in home office environments or where space is limited. These devices are often used with a computer but can operate alone to copy and fax documents. These devices have advantages in that all of the devices are in one unit, print, scan, copy, fax. They are low cost, they are easy to upgrade since software will work with all of the devices, and the connection is easy because there's only one port to deal with. The disadvantage of these devices are that they're not modular, so if one part of it breaks, other devices may not be operational, and they are not designed necessarily for heavy use. I think they're getting better. I noticed that with the scanners, they're not usually quite as fast, so they may not be quite as good for OCR text. And sometimes the scanning area is small, so you may not be able to get a large book on one of these. I've seen some of these and thought, God, I wouldn't want to do a heavy amount of scanning. Of course, I'm fairly allergic to it, so I don't. But if I were to do a lot, I don't think I'd go with an all-in-one. If you have the space, having a separate printer and scanner can work better for you. You can't easily get big books onto these, like I said, on the flatbed of these. If you could get a separate good scanner. Carrie has this scanner, and I think you said it was a plus tech, and it scans at like 7 seconds a page or something, and I'm like, ooh, I think I want one, but I don't know how expensive they are. But that sounds really cool. And it has a book edge too. So that's
$300.
Oh really? That's not bad at all. Wow.
There you go. Okay, cool. I've stopped paying attention again now.
Wow.
Okay. Oh, that sounds awesome. Flatbed scanners are often used to scan books and photographs for archiving. And the all-in-ones usually, nowadays, have a flat scanning bed on the top. They didn't always. And it used to be you could buy a scanner that all it did was sheet feed. That's pretty much gone now. An electronic image is acquired by placing the book or photograph face down on the scanner glass. The scanner head, consisting of an array of image sensors, lies beneath the glass and moves along the item that's being scanned and captures the image. Sheet feeders can be used with flatbed scanners to scan multiple images. A sheet feeder is a device that can be attached to some flatbed scanners to hold multiple sheets and feed them into the scanner one at a time. I saw a Canon high-speed scanner that did these at an amazing rate, and it was like so cool. We had a Braille production center, and I think it's still going at our blind school, that had this just absolutely amazing document feeder. This feature allows for fast scanning of larger documents. We used to scan in worksheets this way. However, the image quality is usually not as good as a flatbed scanner that does not use when you're not using the sheet feeder. This is because the document is not as close, is not as flat on the scanner glass. When you put something on that scanner glass and you put the lid down on it, it's not going anywhere. But with the document feeder, you don't have as much contact between the page that is going through and the scanner glass. Okay, now I don't actually have a demo of a flatbed scanner going because I thought most of you have probably heard these. However, what I do have is a demo of an older scanner playing For a Lease by changing the resolutions and things. And I need to get this ready. I wasn't quite as prepared this time, so it will take me a moment to... Let's see, is it still on my... Yeah, here it is. Okay. So it'll take just a second and fix it. I absolutely love this thing. And it's got a video and everything. Okay, here we go. Oh, I want him to hear it. Okay, well, I'll play it again anyway. And at the end, if people want to hear it one more time, I will play it then. So here we go. And there's a video too.
Wow.
That is pretty cool.
Oh my gosh. Weird. That's just as bad as the one video my husband and I saw on YouTube a few days ago. Two floppy drives playing the Imperial March. Oh. That is so funny.
I don't think the scanner was in very good shape after that.
Yeah, that probably so cool. Not.
No, I wouldn't think so. It probably went to the garbage can.
It's probably done now. One of the older HP scanners, if you set the SCSI ID a certain way and did a certain thing when you turned it on, would actually do Ode to Joy, but that wasn't nearly as interesting. It would just go do-do-do-do-do. It wasn't quite as entertaining as that. Okay. Handheld scanners. This is a small and portable device. It is difficult to smoothly scan an image using a handheld scanner. This is probably really true for blind people, especially. To scan an item, you carefully pass the scanner head across the item that you want to scan. As with a flatbed scanner, digital images are made from the images collected by the handheld scanner. When you want to scan an item larger than the head of the handheld scanner, you must make more than one pass to capture the full image. It may be difficult to recreate the original image digitally when it is scanned in more than one pass. The images must be put together to form a single image of the item that was scanned. And I believe a handheld scanner was used in some of the older Kurzweil personal reader machines before the automatic flatbed scanner was actually integrated into, like, the Reading Edge. A friend of mine actually has one. She didn't have the hand scanner, but she had the automatic one that was a separate piece. And my God, that thing was loud. And Carrie also tells me, and Will was talking, Carrie and Will were talking about, that a hand scanner for the Eureka Note Taker in Australia was made that would plug into the USB port, and they tried to make little rollers that would make it easier to roll it across the page, and it apparently didn't work very well for most people. Kind of sad that Note Taker never caught on here, because it sounded really cool.
It was very sweet, the Eurekas. They had their own system for music composition, and it could actually play like 10 lines of music. And they were really interesting.
Oh, did you get to play with one?
Oh, sure. I mean, like, they were round. Like, I'm old. I don't know. Not so many people had them here, but they were always around.
I was going to say, I've certainly never seen one, but that would be cool.
Will is Mr. Eureka. Sorry.
Ah. We'll have to talk about... If we really want more, we can talk to him about them on social or something. Speaking of, do we have anything scheduled yet for tomorrow? Of course, the last time I asked this question, you both answered it at the same time. I don't think we'll have that again, but... The one time. Carrie, I have a question for you.
Yes, Sean.
Do we know what's going on tomorrow yet?
Tomorrow there's an imaging chat on GRML. I just haven't announced it yet.
Cool.
I'm showing out how to do imaging up netbooks and going into how the UDEV stuff works and how the Simlink stuff works and a few of the utilities and stuff in GRML and how to image up hidden partitions and all that sort of good stuff, whether to compress your images, DD, NTFS clone, and basically how to restore and put back entire computers with GRML. That is what is going on tomorrow.
Cool. All right.
Sorry, Gemma. I'm on Skype to Gemma as well, you see, people, so I'm kind of not here.
Oh, okay. All right, fair enough. Tell her hi. Okay, the next scanner we're talking about is a drum scanner. And these produce high-quality images. These used to be more common They are still used in archiving things like photographs and paintings in museums. But now more flatbed scanners are doing this because they're cheaper and the quality of them is going up. To scan an image using a drum scanner, you attach the image to a revolving drum or load it into a supporting canister. The drum is rotated at high speed across the optical scanners. The optical scanners move slowly across the drum surface until the entire image is captured. The captured image is then reproduced by the computer as a digital image file. That's pretty much all we see about those. I did find a video on YouTube, and it took forever for the guy to like get it set up and explain how it worked and calibrate it, and then I was just like, okay, this is gonna take longer than I thought. And yeah. So if you want to, you can try and find them. So that's the last scanner type we talk about. Now we're going to talk about installing and setting up scanners, amazingly. When you purchase a scanner, installation information, such as a quick start manual or will usually come with it, as it does with a printer. Follow this carefully. A CD containing drivers, manuals, or other scanning software should also be included. These can also be downloaded from the manufacturer's website, and this is, of course, the best place to find them. Sometimes on these CDs, you'll get a demo of an OCR product that you won't necessarily find in the driver pack. And if you use this and you can, you know, give them the code or whatever to prove that you have it, you may actually get a discount on the full product. I know this was the case with a scanner my dad got that had OmniPage 2 limited edition, and you could apparently get a discount to the full version, which we never did because the scanner was just awful. This was a parallel scanner when those were around. The first thing you want to do when you get your scanner is read the manual that comes with it in the box of the scanner or on the CD, as we talked about. Unpack the scanner from its box, take an inventory of the box contents, and make sure everything is included that should be. If this is a flatbed scanner, remove any tape holding the scanner closed. Also, this is very, very, very important. Before turning the scanner on for the first time, you must unlock the shipping lock. This is a mechanism in flatbed scanners that keeps the light bar from moving during shipment. If you turn the scanner on without undoing this lock too many times, you can cause serious damage. You will know when you've done this. It will go, you will definitely know. The location of this lock is different from scanner to scanner, so consult the quick start information. Sometimes it's on the bottom, other times it's a slide switch on the back, like with my 1660 Epson, it was a slide switch. On this other one here, it's a little knob, you have to put like a coin in and turn it. Carrie said that the new scanner he has, what it does is that when it has something that when it's sitting on the desk, it pushes this thing that unlocks it. And then when it's not, it locks it back in again, which I think is incredibly smart, and that will save a lot of accidents. Again, that sounds cool. Some scanners receive power from an electrical outlet, and others obtain power directly from the USB or FireWire interface. Interfaces for scanners are USB, FireWire, Ethernet, usually in the case of the all-in-one devices, parallel or SCSI for some older scanners. Like I said, we had an old, I think it was like Microtech or Random something, and it was parallel, and the way to make it go fastest was to set the parallel port to EPP in the BIOS, but then the printer didn't like it, so you were constantly going into the BIOS and flipping it around, and it was just bad. And so it didn't get used very often. You're going to connect the appropriate power and data cables to the scanner, and the device driver updates are fairly similar. Follow the directions in the manual or other material on the setup that came with the scanner. Manufacturers are usually very specific about how the driver should be installed and in particular when to connect the scanner, like I mentioned. Either they might do it before the installation begins or during the installation when you're prompted. This is goes for printers
story?
As well. Yep.
It's not actually a scanner or a printer, but I actually didn't do this when I installed my Focus 40 Braille display. And oh my wordy yes, Chanel, did I battle for about 2 hours, because you must not have the display connected when you install the driver. Otherwise, you've got to blow away every piece of JAWS and its shared components and smash the int files out of the Windows directory. So don't think it's going to be all right. And no, ooh. System Restore didn't save me. So do pay attention to whether you need the device plugged in or not. That's really important. And unfortunately, it's usually printed on a piece of paper that you can't read that's attached to the device. Bit of a chicken and egg problem. If you had the scanner attached, you could scan it.
Yeah. After you've connected and started the scanner, the computer operating system might be able to discover the scanner through the PNP process. If the scanner is discovered, the operating system again might automatically install a driver. Whether this is what you want to do and what you want to happen will depend again on the instructions given by the manufacturer of the device. Now, I had an someone I'm working with had an experience the other day. We had a scanner that we had never used on Windows 7, and we wanted to set it up. So he installed the drivers, and he read the directions, and double-clicked on the setup file, and nothing showed up on the screen. No dialogue, no progress bar, nothing. And he thought, oh crap, I don't think this worked. But when the computer was rebooted, it worked perfectly. I don't know why. I've never seen this. So they're all different. And I don't even know what kind of scanner it was. It's a Canon something. I don't remember. But I was just like, wow, you've got to be kidding me. After the scanner has been set up, install the driver that came with the scanner or download one from the manufacturer's website, maker's website, and use it. And we've already talked about why doing things from the manufacturer's website is a good thing. Kind of like with the laptop, you could almost do a drinking game every time they tell you how important that is when you read these. Almost like the laptops can be run off an AC adapter or battery. They really want you to know this. Follow the instructions provided to install the driver as you need that you need from the manufacturer's website. After making sure that the right one, save the directions somewhere, or you can refer to them. Some scanning software automatically downloads and installs updated software drivers or firmware for you. Follow the directions provided by the update utility, if this is the case, to install these files. There is a lab on installing an all-in-one device, finding documentation, other stuff. Read it if you like. You don't have to turn anything in. But it kind of goes into some of the same steps that I talked about. Configuration options and default settings. Scanners have these as well. They have their own settings and defaults that are unique to them. A scanner might come with a basic graphics editing software package for editing photographs and other images. Editing software packages might include OCR as well. And as we talked about, that allows you to turn scan text and into text that you can manipulate. Some possible configuration options include the following: color, grayscale, or black and white scanning, one-touch scanning into your choice software, into your choice of software, quality and resolution choices, sheet feeders, whether they're used or not. Color calibration between devices is important so that you see true representations of color. To calibrate a scanner, scan a graphic that comes that contains specific colors that comes with it. A calibration application installed on the computer compares the output of the scanner against the known colors of the sample graphic on the display. The software adjusts the color and the scanner accordingly.
Just another point that I was going to mention with the plus text. I don't know whether anybody else has seen this, but it actually gives you a progress indicator as the light warms up, so that if you don't think your scanner's doing anything, you can actually check and go, no, it's cool. 60% warm.
That's neat!
Yeah, it was really cool.
The software adjusts the color of the scanner accordingly. I'm sorry, I already read that. When your scanner, monitor, and printer treat the same colors in the same way, the image you print matches the image you scan and the image you see. Now, while this might not seem important to us as blind people, your customer may find it very important. So, and they need to know that it's an option and how to do it. So you at least need to know that it's an option that you might need to play with. Printers and scanners have many moving parts that wear out over time or through extended use. They must be maintained regularly to operate correctly. Moving parts can be affected by dust and other air particles. Clean printers and scanners regularly to avoid downtime, loss of productivity, and high repair costs. For printer maintenance, as we said, printers provide or have many moving parts and require a higher level of maintenance than most other electronic devices. Actually, laptops require a lot too. Impurities are produced by the printer and collect on the internal components. Over time, if the impurities are not removed, the printer can malfunction. The maintenance schedule for a printer can be found in the manual or on the manufacturer's website. Caution: be sure to unplug the printer from the electrical source before beginning any type of maintenance. Most printers come with printer monitoring and diagnostic software from the manufacturer that can help you maintain the printer. Observe the guidelines from the manufacturer for cleaning the following printer and scanner components. Actually, I saw someone I was talking to on Team Talk the other day. He was like, "Oh, let me log into this web page and see how much toner and how much my ink cartridges are doing." And I was like, "That's just cool." So, anyway, sorry about interrupting myself. Find out how to clean the following components: printer roller surfaces, print and scanner paper handling mechanisms, the type and quality of paper and ink used can affect the life of the printer, paper selection. High quality paper can help to ensure that the printer operates effectively and for a long time. Sometimes printers have a hard time feeding in really thin sheets, and if you get rips while that's happening, that's not good. Many types of printer paper are available, including inkjet and laser. The printer manufacturer might recommend the type of paper to use for best results. Some papers, especially photo paper and transparencies, have a right and wrong side. So do letterheads, actually. Load the paper according to the manufacturer's instructions. Get sighted help to do this. Ink selection. The manufacturer recommends the brand and type of ink to use. If the wrong type of ink is installed, the printer might not work or the print quality might deteriorate. You should avoid refilling the ink cartridges because the ink can leak. There is a advertisement out there that I believe Epson did that Carrie told me about, where it had a washing machine and they had put wet concrete into it and said, "This is what putting refilled ink can do in your printer." And apparently, if you want to make printer technicians go absolutely insane, you tell them about how you tried to refill your ink cartridges using the little kits with the syringes and all that. Some companies will actually refill them for you, but again, even though it's not as expensive, buying a new one is probably going to be more reliable than using something that's been refurbished or recycled or refilled or whatever. For scanners, the scanner surface should be kept clean. If the glass becomes dirty, consult the manufacturer's user manual and cleaning recommendations. To prevent liquid from leaking into the scanner case, do not spray glass cleaner directly on the device. And this is true when you're using wet cleaners on anything. Usually, you don't want to spray it straight on to what you're cleaning. Dampen a cloth with the cleaner and then apply the cleaner gently to the glass. If the inside of the glass becomes dirty, check the manual for instructions on how to open the unit or remove the glass from the scanner if this is possible. And if it is, thoroughly clean both sides of the glass and replace the glass as it was originally set in the scanner. I think some of them are sealed and you can't. I would be really, really afraid I would drop it. When the scanner is not in use, keep the lid closed. Put handheld scanners in a safe place. Also, never lay anything heavy on a scanner because you can damage the casing or internal parts. I'm really bad at this. The scanner I have is pretty sturdy. I tend to put stuff on the part below the document feeder. Oopsies. Which I know is a very bad idea.
The problem is that if you put stuff on the glass, it may not break it straight away, but the more things you put on the glass, the more stress fractures you're actually going to have on the glass itself. I certainly rouse at one of my significant other for leaving the scanner open because stuff falls onto the glass, which is why they want you to close it, like dust and bugs and whatever else, and then when you go to scan the mail, it just doesn't come out quite the same way.
Oh yeah, because you guys have got crazy bugs over there too.
Not that many.
Something else to think about, as well. I've had scanners open when scanning very big books, and that's great, but obviously you want to close it when you're done. Okay, where are we? Okay, right now the section that I'm looking at here is the troubleshooting process, and we are not going to go through that. I had basically, this was the first lecture I ever did, and I put it in here in case we needed to, and we aren't, because hopefully you guys are looking at these now. Okay, we are now ready for the quiz, if there are any questions that need answering before that.
I'm ducking off to the loo. Before John asks his question, how are we going to test that people are actually looking at the troubleshooting process, or do we just pretend that they are?
You know what? If they're not, they're going to have issues on the tests, because they will have looked at the troubleshooting, and we'll be able to see that when we go over exams with people. They're like, oh, you got this wrong.
You know what?
The troubleshooting section.
I've decided this quiz probably won't take very long. Why don't we do that after the quiz, even though I really would prefer not to? Why don't we actually do it, since we are going
to
have
guys.
Some extra
time?
Yeah,
I reckon we should. It's only 10:22.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, we should have time.
Yeah, and this quiz is short, so...
Yeah, all right. I'm ducking down to the room of requirement, so... Oh, and John had a question.
Yes, John, you did have something.
It was just about... reliable ways to find the model numbers and things. If you have a scanner or printer that you haven't checked the model of for a while, is the device manager generally pretty reliable, or is it still, obviously the best way is maybe to have the sighted person look at the actual device to see what the model number is, as far as looking at the
manufacturer's website?
I wouldn't
have a sighted person look at the device, because if the manufacturer does not want the printer connected until after they've installed their drivers, then you've just messed up what they want you to do, and that can be loads of fun, as we talked about earlier. Usually it's easy for a sighted person to tell you what it is, so, you know, just grab somebody and have them look really quickly.
The other thing is, though, Sean, when you plug them into the device manager, they usually show up as USB printer or USB scanner, which isn't very useful. So,
yeah.
Yes, you've violated the thing. If you really, really need to find out what something is and no sighted person is around... boot up a copy of GRML, plug the thing into your USB port, and then get the USB vendor and product numbers, and then Google those up. But that's if you really don't have anybody sighted to look. But that's one way of identifying things. I've had to do this.
Cool. Alrighty, let's do a quiz. Is everybody in there chatting ready to go?
Now I am.
Yep, I'm looking. Yep, everybody's here. Good. Yay. Number one, which technology is used by dot matrix printers? Is it A, digital drop, B, electrostatic spray, C, electrophotographic, D, ink melting, or E, impact? Answer now. Ooh, we got answers all over the board. The answer is impact. Remember, those are the loud ones that go nee, nee, or because you've got things banging into the ink ribbon, which is hammering, putting the character onto the page with impact. So that's what your dot matrix, your daisy wheel printers are. Those are impact printers. Number two, which phase of the laser printing process includes applying toner to the latent image? Is it A, cleaning, B, conditioning, C, developing, D, fusing, E, transferring, F, writing? Answer now. Have a think. Any more answers? Okay, we're applying toner to a latent image. So the answer is actually C, which is developing. That's the only thing... Well, actually, no, because writing has to do... Developing is the answer they're looking for. Number three. What are three disadvantages of impact printers? Choose three. So this is yes or no. How about A, expensive consumables? No, that is not a disadvantage of these. How about B, high power consumption? No, that is not a disadvantage of these. That's actually an advantage of these, come to think of it. C, limited color capability. Yes, that is correct. How about D, noisy printing? Absolutely, those were the noisy, funny sounding ones. How about E, slow printing? That's correct. That is another disadvantage to these. We have our three. Also, the other one they have is... Yep, go ahead.
I say the paper would tear, and like as a combination of the thing that it printed slow, like we would have jobs that had to print for like days, and we set up a job to print, and then the paper would tear or get offline, and you've lost the whole thing. So you have to pay people to go in on the weekend just to make sure it hadn't gone offline to restart it, so we wouldn't waste the whole weekend of printing.
Yeah, I know that the other thing that they list as a disadvantage, which of course is wrong, is unable to use continuous feed paper. That's what they do use. The continuous feed is another disadvantage. I remember the Juliet printer we used to have would go doo-doo-doo-doo, and you could hear it for miles, but it was good that you knew it was out of paper, because if you wasted time, then your job took even longer. Number four, which type of printer melts ink and sprays it through a nozzle onto a drum to transfer an image onto paper? Is it A, fusion ink, B, impact, C, inkjet, D, laser, E, solid ink, or F, thermal? Choose now. Very good, it is solid ink. 5. Which type of printing process uses solid sheets of ink that change directly to gas when the print head heats the ink? Is it A, dye sublimation, B, impact, C, inkjet, D, laser, E, solid ink, F, thermal? Answer now. No, it is A, dye sublimation. Thermal printers heat it, but remember, the reason thermal printers work is because the paper's waxy to begin with. Sublimation is when the ink goes from being a solid sheet directly to gas. That's how these guys work. Number 6. Which peripheral is used to convert paper documents into electronic files? Is it A, digital reader, B, printer, C, projector, D, scanner? Choose now. Absolutely, it's a scanner. Number 7. Refer to the exhibit. A customer purchased the scanner shown in the graphic and discovers that it is limited to converting hard copy data into electronic images. Which type of scanner has the customer purchased? And the picture says, A picture displays a relatively large desktop device. So with that in mind, is it an A, all-in-one, B, flatbed, C, handheld, D, laser? Answer now. And I hate this question. Absolutely, it's a flatbed scanner. There you go. Fantastic. Number 8. How is the speed of a laser printer measured? A. Dots per minute. B. Pages per minute. C. Pixels per second. D. Pages per second. E. Pages per week. Answer now. It's pages per minute. Come on, you guys, choosing D. You're goofy.
Yeah, I was thinking. Has to be a slow printer for.
By the way, impact printers are measured, and I don't think this is mentioned. Impact printers are measured in characters per second. So actually, they, you know, theoretically, that Ooh. Could be pages per week. No, I'm just kidding. If you're talking about a Braille embosser, if you're talking 50 or more characters per second, you're doing great.
Oh, yeah. Braille embossers can be horribly slow.
I have the Braille Blazer is only 15 characters per second, just to give you some perspective
wow.
for those of you who've used them. That's why they take so long. Because they've only got two solenoids, actually, so that's why they take so long. Anyway,
when I used one, I was just glad it was faster than I
That's true. With those things, if you could add the sort of butter smell, it sounded like a popcorn popper. That's what I always thought. Number 9. What is an advantage of a network printer over a local printer? A network printer is cheaper to purchase. B. It has higher resolutions. C. It is used by multiple people. D. It is easier to install and takes less time to configure. Choose now. C. It is used by multiple people is correct. Oh, here we go. I like the... A student... Number 10. A student on a Windows XP computer sent a print job to a newly installed printer that is connected to a home computer. However, the print job fails. Which tool can be used to verify the configuration of the port that the printer is on? Is it A. Device Manager? B. System Control Panel? C. Add Hardware Wizard? D. The Ports tab of Printer Properties? Answer now. Whoever chose D is correct. And the reason this is true is because USB printers, and my Epson did this, can actually emulate a parallel port that DOS programs can then use to print to this printer that doesn't actually have one. That is one of the ones that they really trick you on. And that is the end of the quiz. Oh, wait. I have something else before we go into the troubleshooting process, and that is laser printers, when you start them, sometimes, you know, they just take off, and before you know it, you get pages shooting out and everything. If you have printed the wrong document, or if there's a problem, the first thing you do is turn it off, because by the time you go into the print queue and you try to cancel the job and all of that, it might be, like, too late. Turn it off. Then go into the print queue and have fun canceling the job, and then turn it back on again. That's kind of how Braille embossers worked, too, in the sense that the computer would be done sending it, and even though the embosser was going to hold it in memory and take 5 years, you pretty much turn them off, too, was the quickest way. Okay. Should we just call these off, Grace? How do we want to do these?
Do which?
For the troubleshooting process. Huh?
What are you going to do?
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, let's see if anybody knows the first step and
Absolutely.
Go through them
yeah,
that
what's
way.
The first... Does anyone know the first step of
That's
the troubleshooting process?
Identify the problem?
Absolutely.
Yes.
How about the second one?
Okay. And somebody other than Marlene.
I believe it was establish a theory of probable causes.
That's right.
Fantastic, you're correct. Number 3, new person.
Determine the cause.
Yep, they actually word it as determine an exact cause, but you're close enough. Number four.
Think of probable ways of solving the problem?
Nope.
Implement a solution?
Absolutely.
Yep. Number five?
And actually, Melissa, you shouldn't have answered that one, so someone else.
That's okay.
Oops.
That's okay.
Yeah, well,
I'll get an extra virtual lollipop. No,
absolutely.
Just kidding.
Yeah, you will. Number five.
Anyone know it?
If you guys take too long to answer, we're going to wonder if you're pulling up the module and actually looking at it.
I know. No, I'm just kidding.
I assume that you want a new person, because...
I've
tried to remember these by heart.
Verify that your solution works and that your system will function, you know, with
yes,
the solution.
Verify solution yes. And full system functionality.
That's how they word it, yes. And what's the last one?
Document findings, yes.
Document findings, yes. You guys did better than I... thought
yeah,
you would.
One time we had Drew here, and he was like one of the only people here, and we just completely picked on him, and it was really horrible.
I still miss the old process, although this one makes more sense.
This one actually makes you stop and think before you start going into things, which I...
Yeah, it does, which is why it's better. Plus, I'm probably forgetting parts of the old one now.
Are we ever in the world going to have to come up with all those words in the right order? Or do we, like, you know, I mean, they're giving us multiple choice on exams.
You might
like,
on
if
the
you
file.
Know what you're supposed to
you
do.
Might, yes. You may have to actually order the troubleshooting process. I'm not sure if you ever have to. You used to have to.
Do you have to use that
like
exact,
you were talking about,
the exact wording from the module? Or does it matter?
Yeah.
Like,
there
you have to be able
to
create it out of your own brain.
No, you don't have to create
it
out of your own brain.
Because these are multiple choice exams, but you have to get it. You have to get it in the right order, potentially, or at least choose the one.
Oh, so it'll be like one of the.
I think it was
the chapter 3 exam where they gave you a table of steps and you chose which is the correct order of these steps.
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Or they might actually say,
which is the second step
in
the troubleshooting process.
Which step should they use now? They may actually do it that way, even. They may say which step should be used next based on what the person's done.
Or
so
a person has done
point,
is what step
may,
does this fall
I
under?
Think the point is, the point of the troubleshooting process, and you're sort of going, oh, I have to remember 7 steps or whatever it is. It's so that you actually have a method in your madness. How many times have you had computer technicians that just... I actually had somebody who said to me, and they work for an organization with which I'm intimately familiar, that does a lot of access technology work, and he goes, oh yeah, well, you know how it is, you just mess around with it until it works. And I'm like, no, you don't.
No, you don't.
It's more organized than that, or it should be, rather.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you get to the point where you've exhausted all logical things and you start trying things, but that's usually, like, after you're, like, you know, asking somebody to go to the liquor store for you before you try your last ditch efforts on getting this stuff sorted. But we're trying to teach you a method to your troubleshooting madness, because how many times have you seen people try something that didn't work, try something that didn't work, try something that didn't work, try the first thing that they tried that didn't work, try the third thing that they'd tried that didn't work, and then go, oh, well, I have no idea what else to try now. Well, that was
you're
really
screwed.
Organized, wasn't it? Well, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I hate when people do that. And
I mean, how would you feel if the computer technician that was coming over sort of said, well, yeah, I'm going to mess around with things until they work. I might break a few things. I might destroy a few things. You might see some smoke pouring out of your gear here. But we'll get it going eventually. I mean, does that fill you with happiness? You know, no, a little bit more organization would be good.
Not exactly a confidence booster.
Yeah, we'll have volunteers that come in, and they'll just, you know, fiddle around until they let the smoke out of things, and they have no troubleshooting process. Some of the people, you know, that you deal with in tech support don't have a troubleshooting process, or any, you know, even basis of how to troubleshoot. And this is just trying to make sure that you guys have some basis, when all else fails and you don't know what the problem might be, to start finding a solution.
Well, we had a situation the other day, and this is a very interesting one, without getting into a long protracted discussion, but gave somebody a Linux disk and told them to boot it up and whatever else, and they're sort of pressing things and pressing things and pressing things, and I sort of said, okay, mate, do you want to keep pressing random buttons? Shall I just leave you to it? Or would you like to stop pressing random buttons, and would you like me to actually tell you what you need to do next? And I think this is a trap that a lot of people fall into. Exploring your way around a computer and an interface is a very good thing to do, but it's not the only way to learn, and maybe you might actually need to do some structured learning as well as exploring. Exploring's all well and good, but are you taking a walk in the park, or are you actually trying to get something achieved? And that's kind of what the troubleshooting process is. Yeah, I've had people who've sort of said, data recovery, and they've gone, oh, so I should run check disk on this drive and tell it to fix all the errors. No. You're trying to recover data off that. Don't write anything to this drive until we've got all the stuff that you want off here. But they didn't put any thought into it.
I'm sorry, because I feel like I started this. Do we really have to? And I actually had no objection to... I mean, I think the troubleshooting process sounds good. It's the need to memorize a sentence with all the words in the right order when you understand what you're trying to say you want to do.
You'll see it. But they'll have memorizing it for you the way they want.
Because it's multiple choice, I think the order of the words or the exact wording won't be an issue. Because
this is not Shakespeare. This is not Shakespeare. So what you need to do is you need to say, define the problem, figure out what the problem is, try and trip over the problem, sort out what the problem could be. It doesn't matter how you say it, as long as you get the steps in the right order. We're not going to have a prompter standing around to, shoot you with a water pistol if you get the words wrong. It's just an idea as to what order you take things in.
There's only six of these. If you can't memorize six, sentences in the order they're in, they're not hard.
How old are you?
To be fair, Sean, I don't know them.
How old are you, Sean?
I fail.
Come back and do it again in 20 years.
25?
25. So in another 25 years, to say that, try to repeat the thing you just said. If I'm still around to catch you on it, I'm going to...
I'm with her on this, fair Sean. Enough. My memory isn't as good as what it once was. What did you say your name was again? I had a much better memory 10 years ago. I'm 35. I have to be aware that I have a limited hold capacity. Now, when you're dealing with commands and switches and system administration, that's something you have to come to terms with. So, yeah, I'm going to ask you in 5 years whether you know what the troubleshooting process is. This should be fun. If Twitter's still around, we'll cue audio it.
I suppose I wasn't very nice about that.
I won't know in 5 years, but at least in 5 years, this won't matter. In 5 years, if you're a technician, you are going to have your own way of doing things and troubleshooting.
This is just kind of a basis to start you.
Yeah, we're trying to bootstrap technicians that don't know any better, or technicians that haven't been taught how to troubleshoot, or people that haven't been taught how to do deductive reasoning. So if you have a good idea of what order you do things in, that's enough. You don't have to know all of the exact words. But do read it over each chapter, because it will help cement it in to a degree so that you know what order things are supposed to happen in. And we really do get people who've never opened a computer before or never had to fix their own computer problems. So that's why the troubleshooting process is important.
Yeah. I can tell you, I saw it plenty of times when I was putting those diagrams in, because I had to paste it into every chapter.
But I would wager if we ask you in 2 years and you'd never looked at it, you wouldn't remember. And that's the point
we're
making.
That's true.
And I'm going to bet when you're 50 years old, if you look at it and then have to turn around and repeat it, and somebody says you have to actually memorize it, that your mind is going to go blank.
Absolutely. It's basically a reasoning thing. And you don't have to memorize the exact wording. It doesn't matter. It will be there in the test. It's just making sure that you guys know the six steps vaguely, because you will want to know that, because it may be in test.
My experience
probably
too
in
is
the
if you
final, if it's anywhere.
If you tell people to read something and look at something and we're not going to go through it, there's a good chance that not a lot of people are going to do it, which is why we went through it once today, because we had the time. It's been my experience that if you tell people they should look at something, they go, oh yeah, suppose I should. It's a bit like you should get 20 minutes of exercise a day. Well, not everybody does that.
And I still think the common problems and solutions are something that you should be reading at the end of every single chapter. Even if you don't read the troubleshooting process as often, if you do not read those common problems and solutions, you will miss questions. I can almost guarantee it. Because when I look at the exam and look at it, they'll say, this question comes from 7. What, you know, whatever, whatever. Common problems and solutions. So, read those. There's good stuff in there.